You've seen these before. You've probably contributed to at least one. You may have even used them to power your next business idea, or to fund your life-saving medical care, or next month's rent. The big brand name here is GoFundMe, but there are dozens of crowdfunding sites competing for market share among millions of ordinary people who need to raise money. These sites were created to help with people getting projects off the ground. But over the past decade, they have become a last resort digital safety net. And the digital safety net consists of much more than just crowdfunding sites. It's everything from Reddit users helping you with a complex tax return or benefit, to crowdsourced neighborhood childcare for families who can't afford paid daycare. The raw stats from this digital safety net can give us an idea of where our governments are failing. Should people have to use these programs to stay in their homes or pay for their care? Of course not, but that's what they're doing. So what can we learn from that? How can governments take the data that the digital safety net can offer them and use that information to spend their own money more efficiently and help more people? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Fass Bednar is the executive director of a Masters of Public Policy program at McMaster University, also the author of Regs to Riches. Hey, Fass.
Hi.
Why don't you start, maybe for people who aren't super familiar with everything that your work encompasses, can you talk a little bit about the digital social safety net and the rise of it?
Sure. I mean, basically, in a pandemic context, we've seen people increasingly turn to different digital platforms, either to supplement their income, right? We've seen people go to Etsy to sell more of their wares, maybe sign up for an edgy OnlyFans account. But super social safety nets is more the concept of, instead of turning to charity, or maybe, you know, in the past, religion, like the church might have been a source of support, that people are increasingly, and quite provocatively, I think, making appeals for everyday people to support a financial gap that they have on this platform, which is pretty familiar to us, called GoFundMe. Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating to also think about the traditional data sets that we're using to understand the dynamics and shocks of the pandemic, right? And to recognize that information from private companies are part of understanding the picture, right? Part of understanding the scale. So a recent New York Times article asked, can you really turn your hobby into a career? And that article pointed to Yelp data that was recording business closures and Etsy data that was showing a spike in new sellers. It also pointed to Reddit users, you know, this anonymous forum. I know most people are pretty familiar with Reddit, even if they don't use it ever. But that Reddit users have been coaching each other on how to access unemployment benefits. And I thought that was fascinating because I'm a policy person, fascinated by digital, and to realize that in these online, you know, not corners of the internet, predominant places, people are freely volunteering to help others understand how to access government benefits, which can be a really disorienting and discouraging experience. You know, on the one hand, it's really encouraging. And on the other hand, we shouldn't need these secondary forums mm-hmm. to support people going through that. And it just kind of got me thinking about the digital world and social safety nets.
I want to get into the policy aspects of this in a few minutes. But first, you know, you spoke to the scale and the need for data, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to GoFundMe, for example. Do we have any idea of the scale of this? Like, how many GoFundMes are running? How fast has it grown? And the really crucial question, I guess, when it comes to people trying to meet their needs through this is, what percentage of people succeed with those pleas for cash?
I can't speak to the success rate, but, you know, I can say that the CEO of GoFundMe, his name's Tim Cadogan, a couple of weeks ago published an op-ed, right? He's basically saying in the US that GoFundMe, you know, it's not supposed to be a social safety net in the way that we're seeing. They're seeing restaurants, small businesses, rental, you know, people fighting evictions. Previously, the most common form of fundraising in the US was for healthcare, people to pay medical bills, which is, you know, disheartening and I think points to a policy failure. And I think the main issue, it's a little bit less related to the success rate and just the scale of need that's being expressed on this platform. I mean, it's interesting to think about success too, because there's also a digital divide at play, right? Who can make a compelling appeal? Who has, you know, the photos? Where, you know, who has the social network that shares and amplifies the account? I think that's a really interesting dimension to ask and think about. So I'm glad you brought it up. I don't have the answer ready for you.
No, that's totally fair. But yeah, I'm just fascinated by the idea of, you know, your health or the future of your small business or your rent check or whatever could depend on how good you are at making one of these campaigns go viral. And that just seems like the least equitable way to approach mutual aid.
I mean, on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, policymakers should be using these campaigns as an indicator of the types of programs they should be designing. I love that the CEO is saying, whoa, this is not what we're supposed to be doing. Like, we need, you know, he's making an appeal to Congress to pass emergency aid for monthly bills, restaurants, small businesses, and food. But at the same time, you know, pandemic or not, policy people could be using this platform to look for key indicators. You know, how are we doing? Where are there gaps? And is it time for the state to fill them? So in a Canadian context, we do know that the top campaigns, at least last year, were babies with rare diseases, protest movements, and COVID-19. So, you know, the rare diseases is often a major policy debate. These drugs can be millions of dollars. There's also a kind of split between legal work, right? So one can imagine enterprising pro bono lawyers picking up work off GoFundMe, but also sometimes just arguments in favor of insurance. That said, gender-affirming surgery is something that people are increasingly having to pay out of pocket for. And maybe we need to have more of a health dialogue around, you know, whether these people are properly supported with that goal, or if they should have to pay out of pocket for this work.
When you talk to people who are decision makers and who might be shaping policy, how far have they gotten in looking at what's happening in the digital world as a way to highlight gaps in policy?
I love that question. I mean, I often joke that the policymaker's modern dilemma is this. You know, one, we always say more data is created than ever before. You know, we're creating more data every day than we've ever had. And then on the other hand, we have, well, we're going to need more information, right? There's this thirst for data-driven decision-making, but also a reliance on our traditional inputs, right? Statistics Canada surveys. And I think the pandemic has shown that policymakers were much more open to complementary, supplementary information that helped them understand, again, the dynamic scale and how pronounced the pandemic was. I mean, to make it a little more Canadian, I think of a company like FreshBooks, right? Ostensibly, you know, as simple as digital accounting. Well, FreshBooks has a lot of real-time information on, you know, small and medium-sized businesses, as well as self-employed people. What sectors are growing? What sectors are not? How many more people are starting independent consultancies? What are the newest jobs, right? How do we ensure that a company like FreshBooks sufficiently communicates with government officials and shares relevant information that's aggregated and anonymized to help inform those decisions and directions? I think that's definitely the right question to be asking in 2021.
The demographics of our politicians and the people in charge, are not necessarily compatible with the places where this data is coming from. And when you speak to like, well, they trust Statistics Canada, how can we evolve our perspectives on gathering digital data from places that might traditionally be less trusted?
Well, I think those arrows that are the direction of the relationship need to flip, right? So the traditional model is that, again, let's point to FreshBooks, that a company like FreshBooks would knock on government's door, probably at provincial and federal levels, and ask for a meeting and, you know, say, hey, we've got some data, maybe we could be useful, but we don't have a lobbying ask, like we're literally just around, you know, let us know if there's something we can do. So we have to do more to flip that arrow and have, you know, decision makers, officials create and maintain these relationships, but also have the ability to ask those questions and, you know, be it the CEOs, be it people working on policy, be it on lawyers, and pull them into a room and have those conversations. Or we just would see maybe more research and kind of proactive publications in that regard. We saw that with early in the pandemic, the Open Data. Do you remember that? The restaurant booking site?
I don't. Refresh me, maybe.
Oh, it was, I'm saying Open Data, but it's not the right phrase.
Open Table. I know what you're talking about.
Open Table, yes. Open Table. Like that was really cool, right? By, you know, they did it city by city and by country, and they just started showing trends in people canceling reservations. I don't know really what decision makers were supposed to take from that, but it was often cited, right? I mean, again, looking at alternate forms of data, it doesn't just have to be digital. Throughout the pandemic, people have been citing flight data, highway data, just to proxy people's mobility. And kind of how locked down are we? That's interesting, right? It's different. So I definitely think there's an argument for novelty and newness. And do I think any one company has, you know, the right answer that government needs? No, but it's part of understanding the landscape and really having an enriching sense of what's out there. One other thing, not about Open Table or Open Data, but, you know, change.org petitions are often, I think, the closest that we map in our minds to policy change, right? Because it's because it is people kind of directly lobbying or expressing their support for something. It's very easy to pair change.org petitions with fundraising initiatives that are also on GoFundMe. I think that's an interesting crossover and why GoFundMe is kind of one step away and why it's deserving of policy people's attention. I can imagine someone running for office in the next election, say we have one in Canada in the spring. I don't think it's unrealistic to imagine someone having their receipts of the kind of campaigns they've supported as a politician and why they're going to push for this policy change so that people don't have to fundraise for that specific initiative. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And I'm going to take it one step further because so far we've kind of talked about using digital data to guide policy decisions that will, you know, and I'm going to quote unquote hit people in the real world. What would a real digital social safety net look like? Because you talked at the beginning about, you know, people on Reddit trying to help one another navigate unemployment benefits. And, you know, that is, there's a big divide there. So what would it look like if the data not only informed government decisions, but that the results of those decisions were also provided in an easy to access digital way? You know, I think part of the power of GoFundMe is that people understand how it works.
Well, I mean, one thing to imagine is if you're in the US and you're observing these Reddit communities, you should be taking note of what are the friction points, right? What are people having trouble with when they're filing online? You could imagine people speaking on Reddit about how to book their COVID-19 shot and what's disorienting and, you know, what they need to bring or what questions they're going to need to answer. That's also something where, again, officials building these systems can adjust in real time, update their FAQs, and make sure that the kind of core site is more holistically supportive of what people need.
But shouldn't there be like a Reddit forum on the government site where people can ask actual officials the things they would normally ask random people on Reddit?
I mean, there could be. Sometimes there are chatbots. I think we've seen a lot of AI-powered chatbots on government sites.
Yes, right.
You know, in describing the digital social safety net, I'm not necessarily advocating for its growth or sophistication. I'm more wanting to point to this kind of supplementary, I think it's generous to call it a system, but supplementary system that exists online that is peer driven, right? Strangers helping other strangers. And it's powerful, right? And it's profound, but it can also be extremely sad, right? It takes to make a GoFundMe campaign, it either takes an emergency or, you know, a lot of pride and bravery to put your name to something and say it's what you need. Because again, we're familiar with GoFundMe, but it's either people creating fundraisers for themselves or on behalf of someone else, right? Hey, you know, my friend was in an accident, we're raising money for their family, or, you know, this is going to affect their ability to work. It's different than someone coming forward and being like, I cannot pay my bills. Like, this is an emergency. And it's kind of this like last straw, last layer before further action could happen. That said, to your earlier question, yeah, I think, of course, I think government sites should be as informative and accessible as they can be. But I just a few days ago helped my 94-year-old grandmother book her COVID shot for Quebec, and she doesn't have the internet. And, you know, it was a bit of a coordination piece and just some strange things like, you know, I guess it's a standard quiz they ask everyone, but they're asking her, you know, are you pregnant? Yes or no? Listing her parents. Who are your parents? What are their first and last names? Like, no problem. We filled it out, but I think that could have been improved. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
How does the framing of some of these GoFundMes help or hurt what they're meant to accomplish? And I guess the concept of digital mutual aid in general, I'm sure you're familiar with, maybe more so in America, but also in Canada, with the quote unquote success stories of people who have had to fund their life-saving surgeries or cancer drugs or et cetera, et cetera. And it's often presented in like a positive light.
Oh, that they're able to achieve their campaign.
Yeah.
That they're able to raise their goal.
Or like when you see people start a GoFundMe, there was one, I can't remember how long ago, and this is just a random example of like the students who started a GoFundMe to buy their teacher a car so she could get to school. And it's like, oh, look at this lovely, heartwarming thing that we've done for each other. But to your earlier point, like it reinforces that's not something that social policy should be doing.
I think when we celebrate the campaigns online, you know, what we're really celebrating is a movement of people coming together. You know, most payments are $50 or less to support someone in their time of need. And yes, it can detract from, whoa, this is a state failure. We shouldn't need to do that. But I also think it's okay to celebrate that we found a way to stop that gap, right? That we found a way to create that net for someone, and that it can be strangers, I think, is really powerful. And, you know, something like Kickstarter is another version of GoFundMe in a way that, you know, Kickstarter is idea driven, it supports creativity. I think it helps people access networks that they might not personally hold, right? They may not have the cell phone numbers to text and call and raise the money that they need for their creative endeavor. But it's, you know, obviously fundamentally different as well in terms of what they're supporting for. That said, big role for government. Some of what people need, which goes on GoFundMe, is probably, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's not something available from the government, but it goes back to, it's difficult to navigate. You might not know. You might be fundraising for a funeral and not know that there are programs for low-income people to access funding for a funeral. Another morbid example for me, but, you know, again, just because something is on GoFundMe doesn't mean that it's not provided by government. It's just a fascinating space to layer in that I think is historically new and definitely wasn't there a generation ago.
Last question then. If you could ask the government, and here I guess I'm generalizing and saying the federal government, but it could be any level, to take one concrete step towards maximizing the value of the data that's already out there? What would it be? Do we need a digital data arm of StatsCan or something like that?
I think StatsCan is getting increasingly entrepreneurial and open to new forms of data sharing and data access. I think in the last Liberal platform, there was discussion of a data commissioner. You know, that could be someone that helps take a leadership role in terms of, again, supportive supplementary use of data that's otherwise privately held by companies, probably digital companies. I think it would be powerful to hear reports like this cited and kind of addressed. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to go to a fundraiser and see that Justin Trudeau had also given $25 to, you know, support a fallen miner's family, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's something interesting about just thinking about our political class not ignoring these cries for help, right, that have been digitized and formalized. I think they need to be at the forefront of platform creation and also evaluating whether we've been successful with certain initiatives.
Vass, thank you for helping explain this to me. It's such a complicated subject, but that was a great conversation.
It's very nice to talk to you. And, you know, if we ever need support, I feel like you and I both have networks we could go to, and we won't be on GoFundMe. But for anyone who's listening, if you want to go to GoFundMe, I think it's a really eye-opening experience. Search around what's in Canada, get angry, but also see if you can find a couple of extra dollars to support someone that does need your help right now.
Vass Bednar of McMaster University and the author at Regs to Riches. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Fill out our survey while you're there. You could win a tote bag with our logo on it. It's extremely limited edition. You can also find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can find all our shows on Twitter at Frequency Pods and at FrequencyPodcastNetwork.com. We have a whole bunch of new ones, another new one coming this week. If you like dogs, keep an eye out for it. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.